I'm Matt Gillum in for Gemma Gaudette. It's Friday. We want to get you updated on everything that has happened this week in our region. And that means it is time for the Reporter Roundtable here on Idaho Matters. Joining us live in studio today are Kevin Richard with Idaho Education News, Melissa Davlin, the host of Idaho Reports on Idaho Public Television, and Kimberly Crucy, a reporter with the Associated Press. Thank you to the whole team for being with us today.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
All right. So, Kevin, let's dive right in. Let's talk about the Boise School Board elections. First off, what was turnout like? Did very many people even know the election was actually happening?
Apparently not. Turnout was about 4% or a little bit south of that, which, you know, it's kind of what you get when you have a school district with a charter that calls for their school board elections to be held the day after Labor Day. So not many people showed up and not a lot of drama. The two incumbents, Troy Roan and Maria Greeley, won easily. Alicia Esty, who's an administrator at Boise State University, who kind of became sort of the heir apparent to A.J. Belukov, who's retiring from the school board. Esty won easily as well. So there was not a lot of drama at the polls, maybe a little bit more drama after the fact on Twitter as one candidate was not happy with the outcome.
Twitter rant?
Lots of blockage going on. But I mean, there could be rants that none of us on this panel know about because, blockage happens.
A little context. I mean, candidate Brandon Durst was pretty upset. I mean, he placed fifth in this six-way race and was put a lot of blame on the Boise Democratic and North End establishment, that machine that really put their weight behind the three candidates who ended up winning. Brandon Durst, of course, former lawmaker in Idaho, has a history of rabble-rousing, I would say. You know, he's not afraid to ruffle feathers. He's voted against, he was a Democrat. He's voted against his party multiple times. And so, and also I think most notably has a couple restraining orders against him from previous relationships that
and
were
so
reported
that came
on
out during the during the campaign. Yeah. So, and it lent an undercurrent of tension in this campaign. So even though the turnout was low and the outcomes were fairly one-sided, there was more of an undercurrent of tension and maybe more of a whisper campaign going on regarding this Boise School Board election as opposed to others. So you have, to wrap it all up, you have one new school board member and you will have a second because Doug Park has tendered his resignation from the school board, and that's going to come up at the school board meeting on Monday. That will be an appointment process, so there won't be another election. There won't be another school board election until 2020, so mark your calendars for the Tuesday after Labor Day in 2020. There will be another appointee, so there will be two new school board members in a fairly short amount of time.
Well, mark your calendar, everybody. But so what does this mean, though, for students and parents in the district? Is there anything significantly going to change with these new people joining the board?
I wouldn't expect that because you do have the two incumbents who are reelected. And as Melissa mentioned, Alicia Esty has a lot of support from a lot of the same folks in town who support the incumbent. So I don't expect a whole lot of turnover. And, you know, we'll see who gets appointed to the other seat. But that's, you know, the school board's basically going to decide on a successor. So I would not expect a great deal of tumult on the board.
Okay, so let's stick with education for the moment. Idaho Superintendent of Public Instruction, Sherry Ibarra, she unveiled her school budget proposal for next year. She wants a 6.8% boost in state funding. So let's talk about that. And there was also a bit of problematic math. Kimberly, do you want to start with this one?
Yeah. So this is pretty run-of-the-mill around this time. The superintendents in every state agency unveils their budget and what they are hoping to spend. And they're going to come January. They're going to ask lawmakers to give them exactly what they want. We'll see what happens. Ibarra, Superintendent Ibarra, who is running for re-election this year, part of her 6.8% when out of the original budget promised pretty ambitious teacher pay increases. Idaho is already on a five-year plan to boost teacher pay, but she, in her budget, said that she was adding more money at this around $28 million mm-hmm. dollars more to boost teacher pay from about 37 to 40.
Right, it would raise the minimum to 40,000 right. And the high end to 58,000. Pretty big raises.
Teachers were going to be getting like multi-thousand-dollar
yes.
raises,
yes.
both new and experienced.
Exactly. And a pretty attractive thing to tout on when you're running for re-election. However, the next day, her office had to backtrack that and said that they had a pretty big $100 million accounting error, that teachers would not be getting these multi-thousand dollar raises. Instead, they would be getting maybe multi-hundred dollar raises, a little bit different.
Yes.
So then they counted this as Ibarra's office pointed to Tim Hill, one of her aides inside of her office, and said, hey, this is we're sorry, but at least teachers are getting something more. So it's we're still seeing some fallout. We'll see how the fallout from this accounting error is going to affect her.
Is this impacting her in any way? Is she owning it? Is she
just running against Sherry Ibarra? I think you now have a little bit more.
You've got something for the canon there.
Yes.
And it was a fairly unusual news release. The second news release, the one where they had to walk back the promises made on Tuesday, in the sense that, you know, she laid the blame on a staffer, not just any staffer. Tim Hill has been doing school finance in the State Department of Education for Democrats and Republicans in the superintendent's office. I mean, he is probably one of the few people in the state who really understands how school finance works. I mean, he's not a neophyte and he's not an amateur. So to see Ibarra, you know, basically lay the blame at the feet of a senior staffer in the middle of an election season, that was unusual.
And just to point out, the press release that was mentioning the error did not actually say how big the error was. I have to give props to Betsy Russell, the Idaho Press, who first pointed out that it was going to be $100 million. The department was not forthcoming with how big of an error.
She's the one who had asked, hey, how much would it have cost to do all that you said you were going to do? So, yeah.
And, of course, Superintendent Ibarra has a history of having flubs during campaign season. There were some pretty big ones in 2014 when she was first running for superintendent, including some accused plagiarism on her campaign website, a false claim of having the endorsement of all of the Legislative Budget Committee. That ultimately didn't seem to hurt her. She, of course, beat the Democrat in that race in 2014. So while Cindy Wilson might try to use this against her, we'll see if it actually works.
And I had a chance to talk to Cindy Wilson on Wednesday. This was before the accounting error came to light. But she was already critical of this budget proposal. She was saying, you know, this is really not an aggressive plan for teacher pay. It's really, when you get right down to it, it's just continuing this five-year career ladder to raise salaries. There's not a whole lot of new here in her view. And that was, you know, before this accounting error came to light. She's also been pretty critical of Ibarra's plans to put money into school security. Her criticism being that Ibarra, you know, hatched this plan without really consulting with the stakeholders. So a couple of talking points emerging already.
We are speaking with our reporter roundtable, Kevin Richard with Idaho Education News, Melissa Davlin, the host of Idaho Reports on Idaho Public Television, and Kimberly Crusey, a reporter with the Associated Press. We'd love to hear from you. You can connect with us via email at idahomatters@boisestate.edu, on Twitter at KBSX915, or on our Facebook page at Boise State Public Radio. So let's take a bit of a switch here, go from education to a matter of life and death, literally. I'm looking at you, Melissa. You have been working on a story about life expectancy by county in Idaho. It turns out you're going to live a lot longer in some counties than others. Let's cut to the chase. Where do we need to be moving to?
You're going to be fine if you live in Teton County or Blaine County or Ada County, basically the wealthier counties in Idaho, and there's no real surprise there. This is a story idea that I got during fellowship training over the summer that actually Kimberly attended as well, where we were looking at life expectancy discrepancies by zip code in some of the major cities in the United States. When I got back to Idaho, I looked to see if there was any sort of analysis in Idaho, and there really wasn't. Nobody had collated this data. And so while I was working on some other projects when I had time, I started putting together this database. And there were some pretty big surprises. The biggest difference I saw was between Benoit County in North Idaho and its neighbor to the south in Latah County. If you live in Benoit County and you're a man, you can expect to live 8 years shorter, 8 years less than neighbors just a half an hour down the road. And there are a number of factors in that. it's not just access to medical care and insurance, although that plays a part. It's also poverty. It's also education level. It's access to healthy food, fruits and vegetables. There are so many different factors. And so in my reporting, I found that those factors vary between counties with lower life expectancy rates. You know, the factors that are going to make someone's life shorter in Jerome County are different than the factors in Benoit County. But ultimately, it is a complex picture, and a lot of it ties to poverty, economic security, education, and access to health care.
Now, is this yet to come out, or it's coming out right now?
It will come out as soon as I figure out the formatting on my blog this afternoon. So, yes, the reporting's all done. It is ready to publish. But the internet's not working with me. But I'm excited about this reporting because it kind of opens the door to some bigger discussions.
Do you think it will affect change?
Well, does anything we do affect change? I think that it will. I'm hoping that people will take a step back and realize that there are much more complex factors to public health than just access to insurance and access to a healthcare clinic. You know, this is a complex social problem. And I think, you know, if I can get on my soapbox for a second, when we're talking about public policy, so often the issues are siloed. We talk about education, we talk about just tax policy, we talk about just transportation, but all of these are connected. And this story, what I'm trying to do with it is show that it's not as easy as, okay, we open up another health clinic and suddenly people in Benoit County are going to live 8 years longer. That's not it. It has to do with education investments and economy and living wages and all of these things. And people need to start talking to each other in the policy arena and making those connections. We can't be siloing these topics anymore.
Our reporter roundtable continues now. With us today, Kevin Richard with Idaho Education News, Melissa Davlin, host of Idaho Reports on Idaho Public Television, and Kimberly Crusie, a reporter with the Associated Press. Kevin, it has been a very busy week in the world of education. The state is coming out with a new reading test. What is it, and how is it different from the old one?
Well, even as we speak, kindergarten through third grade students are taking a new reading test. It's more computer-based, and what the state is hoping to get and what teachers are hoping to get is a more comprehensive look at reading skills, especially with kids as they come back to school in the fall. They get a better sense of where their strengths are and where their weaknesses are. This whole test, in one form or another, has been around for about 20 years, and the idea is that it's a screener. It's supposed to kind of give a sense of strengths and weaknesses. They call it an indicator. The idea being that it's supposed to help teachers, help students who are at risk of falling behind in reading. So a brand new test, a whole new set of metrics, really can compare these new scores with the old scores. And when the new scores come out in October, the state is expecting the scores to drop. They expect that since the state is measuring kids in so many different aspects of reading aptitude and reading skills or pre-reading skills, that the scores are going to drop, that students are going to fall below grade level in one area or several areas. And they're expecting a drop off in scores, but they're saying you really shouldn't compare the two tests and the two scores. And I think there's some validity in that.
Now, Melissa, you said you have some firsthand knowledge of the test. What have you been hearing and experiencing?
I do. I have a 5-year-old who goes to kindergarten in the Boise School District, and he took the test in his first 2 weeks of school. And from the mom perspective, not from the reporter perspective, it's interesting because we are told as parents to limit screen time for our children, and that's something that we paid attention to, my husband and I. And then suddenly in the first 2 weeks of kindergarten, my kid is expected to take this reading test that relies on his computer skills and his ability to use this touchscreen computer. And he can do it a little bit, but because we thought we were being good parents, we limit that screen time. And the test ended up being more about computer skills and not, I feel, his capacity to learn how to read over the next year. We've read to my son every single day since he was a newborn. You know, this is something that's really important to my family. And now we're going to have this reading test that shows that he's not ready to learn how to read. I don't, as a parent, think that that's
what's fascinating, because I'm assuming, you know, you've been reading to your child from books, like bedtime stories
absolutely.
And all that physical, tactile things. And then sort of his first exposure to a reading proficiency test is on a screen.
Absolutely.
That's got to be confusing and strange.
And he attended a Montessori preschool that focuses on using your hands and doesn't have the screen time, doesn't have touch screen computers. And so this really was his first exposure to not just test taking, but also these touch screen computers. And, his teacher acknowledged that during that first parent-teacher night that we had, that this isn't going to be an accurate representation of your child's skills, so don't worry about it. So when the teacher herself is saying that, it's frustrating to me as a parent that this is something that is going to be on my kid's record as a measure of his ability, and it's just not accurate. And there's no winning for us.
And it's not a new concern because the state ran pilot tests of this reading test last year. There were about 50 schools and about 13,000 students who tested the test last year. And while teachers had some nice things to say about the new test, and they like some of the data that they're going to see off of the new test, there was a recurring concern that was raised by some of the teachers about just this. Are we testing computer literacy or are we testing actual reading skills? Some anecdotal comments from teachers saying, I've had kids who are in tears because they can't make this work. They don't know how to do this. They're frustrated or they're just pressing the first button that they see because they just are checking out. So this is a concern. And I think the state realizes going forward that they have to be cognizant of the fact that they're asking kids to do something very different in the first couple of weeks of school, in the case of kindergartners.
Going back to our earlier conversation about why these school board elections matter, in the Boise School District with the election that we just had, we're not going to necessarily see a big change, but this shows why education-related elections really do affect children, because this is going to change the trajectory of these reading lessons that our children are going to get. And so this is something that matters from the state down. This is why the superintendent race matters in November. This is why the school board elections matter. And it doesn't just affect people with children. This is going to affect all of us and how our tax money is being spent. And I keep beating this drum and no one listens to me. It's fine.
And on that, we are in the middle of our reporter roundtable here on a Friday. We're speaking with Melissa Davlin, the host of Idaho Reports on Idaho Public Television, Kevin Richard with Idaho Education News, and Kimberly Crusi, the reporter with the Associated Press. We'd love to hear from you. You can reach out to us via email at idahomatters@boisestate.edu. Find us on Twitter at KBSX915 or on our Facebook at Boise State Public Radio. I want to talk about Proposition 1 quickly, the measure looking to bring back historical horse racing in Idaho. This week, a group made up of state and local political leaders launched a statewide effort to oppose the ballot initiative. Question open to the floor. What is going on with that?
I think we're seeing election season heat up. We're 60 plus days away from November 6th. So we're basically right on schedule that a prominent group opposed to bringing back these lucrative betting terminals that were once legal in the state but are now banned. Coming out. They've made a big TV ad buy. You might have seen it. They also are doing radio buys across the state, basically saying the proponents of this are being misleading. Now, in their ads, they're also being misleading. So we have a lot of back and forth information going back and forth. But so before this group launched, the most prominent opponent was the Coeur d'Alene tribe. And now we have a group of former current lawmakers, Senate President Pro Tem Brent Hill. We have former gubernatorial candidate A.J. Balukoff. We have GOP activist from Idaho Falls, Doyle Beck. If you're trying to figure out the theme here, I would argue prominent Mormons in this state, which have sway. And in return, former gubernatorial candidate Tommy Ahlquist has come out in favor, also a prominent Mormon leader, Boise businessman who ran for office for the first time. He has come out in favor of horse racing. So I think we're going to see a lot of interesting money and ads before this issue is through, before we get on Election Day.
One could say a lot of jockeying.
Mm-hmm. Well, jockeying is true. And I think especially with ballot measures, it's all about framing. And I think we're definitely seeing this on this one. The proponents are saying that this is about saving horse racing. The opponents are saying, no, it's about saving slot machines that are not constitutional. The proponents are saying this is going to bring in a lot of money for education. Our Clark Corbin looked at the numbers, and we're talking about maybe $500,000 during the heyday of these historic horse racing machines and the historic betting. $500,000. Even the lottery, which is by no means a cure-all for education funding, brings in $30 million for schools. So we're not talking big bucks here.
But this is an issue that is going to, I mean, I will be fascinated to see how the gubernatorial race will play out. Paula Jordan, a member of the Coeur d'Alene tribe, you know, has basically said, I will be voting no on this, but I will respect the will of the voters. Meanwhile, Brad Little, Lieutenant Governor of Idaho, is the Republican nominee, has said, I support this. Neither one, however, are members of the coalitions or are getting involved in the PACs yet.
Very interesting. So let's get personal for a moment here. Kimberly, this is going to be your last reporter roundtable with us, I hear. You're going to be off on a new adventure. Where are you going?
Yes, I'm actually very sad to be leaving Boise. I leave next week for I'm headed to the Nashville AP Bureau to cover politics in the state house over there. But I've spent 7 years in Idaho. It has been very good to me. And if I keep talking about it too much longer, I will start tearing up because I have been crying all week. The idea of leaving Idaho, it has been very good to me. And
well, had you been to Tennessee before? Do you have any connection to that state?
No. It was a job. I'm very excited for this opportunity. I'm very grateful for this opportunity. It's a little bit more of a high profile state, and I'm excited just to jump in, see some new challenges over there.
Well, of course, we wish you all the best, and we are going to miss you.
Yes.
And finally, I have a note to ask you, Kevin, about college financial aid applications.
Okay.
Go for it.
Okay, very quickly. A story that we posted yesterday looks at college applications and financial aid applications. This really arduous federal financial aid form called the FAFSA. If you're a parent and you're listening, your eyes are twitching right now. I feel your pain as a parent. It's a very complicated form. But anyway, what we found is that fewer than half of Idaho high school graduates actually fill out this form, which qualifies students for federal aid, grants, subsidized loans, work-study jobs. It also qualifies for the state's opportunity scholarship. So without the application, a lot of students are probably leaving some money on the table at a time when the state is trying to get more students to go to college and at a time when college affordability is really kind of the underlying question about, you know, college enrollment and college completion. So anyway, we have that full story online at idohoednews.org.
But a lot of money out there not getting claimed or collected then.
Right. I mean, there's you know, these are need-based programs, especially the federal programs, and to a large degree, the state scholarship. It's designed to help students who would not otherwise be able to afford college.
All right. That was Kevin Richard with Idaho Education News. Melissa Davlin also joining us, host of Idaho Reports on Idaho Public Television, and Kimberly Crusi, the reporter with the Associated Press. She is on our reporter roundtable for the last time from Idaho. Thank you again, Kimberly, for being
Bye,
here.
Kimberly.
We appreciate it.
We'll miss you.
Good luck with everything.
Thank you. There we go. It's a love fest in here on this Friday.